This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Julian Ng and Kusu Chuang, with the top business stories of the day. We're going to be looking at Snapchat and real values, as well as the effects of Obama's fiduciary rule. Now, on that first story, Snap Incorporated, which is the owner of the popular app Snapchat, is working on an initial public offering, or an IPO, that could value the company at about $25 billion. This could be one of the highest profile debuts in years. The question, I guess, some people might be asking, is the company really worth that much?
Well, we don't know, right? A lot of times these things are just, I guess, a stab in the dark. And you have investors going into it because there's such a frenzy these days about going into the leading tech companies. And we know that Alibaba, of course, at the time when it was listed, before it was listed, 150 to 200 billion US dollars. So this is 10%, a fraction of Alibaba. WhatsApp, the other chat app that we are very familiar with, that was bought over by Facebook for a cool $20 billion. So this $25 billion, I guess it's okay. It's just $25 billion.
And it's probably worth more than Deutsche Bank at this point in time.
No, I think you're right, because Deutsche, I think, is worth around about $14-15 billion US dollar.
Well, okay, so a bank has money. I don't know if it has bullion, but it has money. So what does Snapchat have? I mean, it's got a business model. Is that enough to make value?
Okay, so of course, I think Snapchat has 150 million users or something. And, you know, sometimes in the media world, when you make comparisons between old media and new media, you know, for example, you take a 60-year-old channel which gets to, you know, 80 million viewers or something on Nielsen ratings, and then you get something like, you know, one of the new platforms, Instagram or Twitter or whatever, and they take, you know, 5 years to get to 300 million. You've got people like WhatsApp who have, what, 900 million users now? So it's basically the reach and the disruptive effects of the technology.
Okay, so it's the reach, the potential for advertisers to get to your users that gives you that value. Is that what you're saying?
It's also kind of like radio.
Yeah,
absolutely. We are a platform. I mean, you know, we're just providing the whistles and bells for
it. But it's also the capturing the migration, because the migration going from traditional media to online and new social media. If you're in a position to capture that migration, then obviously you're going to be worth a unicorn valuation. And I think the point of this whole story is that even pre-IPO, you know, Snapchat is around about 16, 17 billion. If they go IPO to 25, it's going to make a massive return to shareholders.
Interestingly enough, the reason why Snapchat was popular was because they are the creators of the disappearing message. So if you're worried about your message lingering around privacy issues and the people you're dealing with, you know, when you type something into Snapchat, it's different from WhatsApp. WhatsApp, you can even archive your message and your messages are there forever.
Yeah.
With Snapchat, it sort of dissolves and you get to protect your conversation, the privacy of your conversation.
But is that the only thing for some people? I mean, is that the only thing? Is that the only leg that this whole business model stands on?
I think Snapchat is appealing to investors because it's used by the 15, I think the very young, 10 years old to 25 years old. That's a very common platform for them. They won't use WhatsApp. They won't use Facebook Messenger. And that is the right demographic to be selling stuff to, because you've got another, 40 to 50 years of adulthood to be, you know, to be using your product or service.
I mean, has it been proven that, you know, when you advertise that people actually do buy? I mean, is there any proof in
There's no
the
proof. There's never been any proof, right? But I mean, that...
I apply it to radio. I mean, when people advertise with us, do they buy? Do they actually buy?
Listeners go out and
so the question becomes: does it even matter, right? Because we have we have ownership of a certain number of listeners, and these advertisers are interested.
We don't own the listeners,
but the advertisers are interested in giving that message to our listeners. So I don't think the question is whether or not they buy. I'm sure at some level in the advertising agencies, they will talk about returns on investments and whether these campaigns result in anything more than just...
Yeah, that's why you've got phrases like mind share, market share, eyeballs, eardrums, and things like that that marketers love to use. But the other thing about Snapchat here is the pre-IPO valuation and the actual IPO valuation. You know, the public markets gives you a real value. Like, for example, Sharad, in the private circles, you might say, based on my, 100 years of working...
And my 3,000 Twitter followers.
I might be worth, $50,000 a month in salary, but it's only once you go and look for a job and you get the job offer, then you only get offered, $45,000.
Well, I'm so glad you said $50,000 a month, because I thought you were going to say $50,000, in total.
A century.
Yeah, I also think that social media is changing in very profound ways. Very, very nebulous, I still think, what it is. What's an email? What's Facebook? What's a WhatsApp message, right? Because if you look at something like WeChat, which I suppose China, they try to duplicate the business models that they see from America. WeChat, you have WeChat and you have Snapchat. If you ever been on WeChat, it looks like a Facebook and an email and a Twitter all in one. And a WhatsApp lumped into one, right? So I think social media 5 years down the road would be something so different that's something that we would not even imagine today.
Well, what they say about the WeChat thing, and I use it, I have it just because I always like to experiment with these things, is that function that allows you to send voice messages. And apparently...
No. This WhatsApp allows you to do... WeChat is so popular?
In China, because Chinese characters are difficult to type out.
Also, WeChat is so popular? Because boys can meet girls and girls can meet boys.
Yeah, there is that function.
That always works.
Yeah, yeah. There's a dating function.
That's right. That's all of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Moving on to more serious matters of fiduciary responsibilities. Merrill Lynch is to end commission-based options for retirement savers. Apparently, this is to put them in line with Obama's.
Yeah.
Obama administration's.
This is something Julian feels very strongly about.
Okay, Julian, why do you feel so strongly about this?
I'm very happy about this. I guess if you go back to the meaning of what fiduciary means, it's aligning your interest, your own interest with that of the client, right? So when you charge a commission, you can open up these areas of conflict because you would rather, a normal person would rather maximize commissions rather than necessarily acting on behalf of your client. So what your client deserve is to really only invest in cash and not buy an expensive high commission product like in investing in the stock market, if you were conflicted, you would not sell them that cash product. You would just sell the highest, most profitable product. This is what they want to bring to the United States.
Right. So customers come first in the fiduciary rule. And it always
results in really eliminating commissions.
Okay. Yeah, so as opposed to paying commissions on product moved, you're just paying a flat fee, right?
But is this fair to the people selling the product? I mean, surely they have a right to earn a buck. And
fair to the client too?
But clients are adults, shouldn't they be able to make a decision?
The rule has been abused. Like, for example, Sharad, if I'm your financial advisor and I know your profile, and I really shouldn't be selling you a high risk, high income product and earning 8% from you. But shouldn't you, as a person trying to
access these products, shouldn't you be also asking what is the full range? And I mean, if they don't tell you,
most
the
of the
full
time
range,
customers are blur, is it? They just need to be told.
And that, so the blur factor,
yeah. So the
which
agents,
which I think the Obama administration probably factor, but surely people need. You need to assume that people are fully responsible, that they're not blurred. They go there with full clarity.
You know what Dato' Tan Chin Nam said about the word assume? It makes an ass out of you and me.
I don't think he came out with that.
He did. He wrote a book, exactly. Jules, I'll bet you $100 that's exactly
you're wrong.
Okay, a wager here now.
Shake hands, okay?
Okay. Entire Klang Valley is listening to you guys.
Yeah, we digress.
Okay, yeah. So the thing is, this fiduciary rule, Julian, is it being imposed by fiat? Is government saying you have to do it? Or is it something they've just trying to push the industry towards?
I have a feeling that they're giving people a choice, but at least they're formalizing it in some kind of a law that customers would have a choice whether they want to be with an agent that earns their money through a commission or through a fee under the fiduciary ruling. And I guess your question of being asked whether we should protect the welfare of people selling you stuff or the welfare of retirees, right, who got to save for their retirement, and that becomes very clear which side you should be on. When you say you want to protect these people, I think you're just asking a rhetorical question.
I'm playing devil's advocate here.
I'm sure a bunch of you would have seen John Stumpf's cross-examination in the US. He's the CEO of Wells Fargo, right? He banked $300 million over the last 5 years of his tenure by selling, by making commissions on products sold to customers that didn't need those products. Yeah. I think in Wells Fargo, the target was 8 accounts per customer. And he said 8 is great, right? But you don't need 8 accounts. He was just making money from selling stuff for commission.
But surely, if a company that has that reputation for putting its interests first before clients, it's going to start losing clients. And surely the market will level out in terms of
the
good companies.
Is amazing, right? The kind of promises they make, and everything sounds full of bells and whistles. And for the most part, whether you're an American or a Malaysian,
think of the products you buy, Shira. You're buying products that harms the environment, that harms your body, that harms your future. You're still buying it unless the government steps in to make a rule that, hey, you should no longer sell these products. People will still continue to buy it, right? The other point about this whole thing is that it will really result in the ETF industry expanding ever more than they are right now, because right now about $3 trillion of ETF products are being sold. And these ETF products allow these fiduciaries to act in a very unconflicted position because it is all about passive investing. And it means that you can only make money from advice rather than making bets about markets and about the future, gazing into a crystal ball. And this is what always gets people, right? Somebody coming forward and telling you, hey, I can predict the future. I can tell you how to make
money.
They're
no different from being a snake oil salesman.
Or a fortune teller. And so the ETF industry is expected to benefit from this. Some estimates put it at $10 trillion, growing through to an industry of $10 trillion by 2020.
And I won't say who's an ETF cheerleader in this room.
Julian.
Okay. More top business news after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.